From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The state Supreme Court says Governor Whitmer can't extend emergency declarations indefinitely amid the spread of COVID. That leaves local leaders in charge of putting plans into action.
It's really the public that I'm finding that want us to be diligent and make sure that we keep safe.
The executive of Oakland County joins us. Also, we check in with a teacher about returning to in-person instruction with middle schoolers.
As many challenges as I face as a teacher, like, my kids are, they are the reason why I do what I do.
And writer Alice Randall talks about bringing the vibrancy of Detroit's Black Bottom neighborhood to vivid life.
We all know about Paris in the 20s, but Paris in the 20s pales compared to Detroit in the 40s.
Those stories and more just ahead on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today we speak with a teacher whose Wayne County district is partly back in the classroom. She herself is still seeing some students on the small screen.
I'm seeing some of those kids that are a little more shy, like all of a sudden open up a little bit because they're finding ways of communicating that works for them, that feels authentic and not as scary as like raising your hand in class and everyone listening to your answer.
That's coming up later this hour, but first, much of Michigan woke up to a changed public health landscape this morning, coming off of Friday's state Supreme Court opinion, which found that the governor exceeded her authority, issuing and reissuing orders to require masks, distancing, and restricting public gatherings without approval from the legislature. Some of Michigan's counties moved right away to loosen up restrictions on how people are moving through public space. Others, like Oakland County, have moved just as quickly to install their own rules, restoring some of those restrictions. Oakland County's executive Dave Coulter is with us now to talk about what's going on. Dave, welcome back to Stateside.
It is great to be with you. Thanks.
So over the weekend, your county health officer, Leanne Stafford, said that residents do need to wear masks when they leave their homes. What was the thinking behind acting quickly on this?
We wanted to act quickly for a couple of reasons. The state Supreme Court just recently made their decision about the governor's authority. And we have a number of school districts across Oakland County that are going to be opening up their instruction further starting this week with more in-person instruction. And they had been reaching out to us since the state Supreme Court order about whether or not the old guidelines still applied, and in particularly around masks. And so we felt it was important to offer them guidance and let our residents know that really around a lot of these orders, nothing is going to change in the short term. We have the ability to issue these orders from a local health department perspective.
Well, right. Leanne Stafford cited her authority to take emergency steps under a 1978 state law. Do you expect, given what happened with the governor's orders, that Oakland County might be in for a legal challenge?
You know, I suppose that's always possible. But just remember this, the state Supreme Court case that was heard last week was not aimed at the public health code or the public health code laws that we use to issue orders during an epidemic or a pandemic as we're facing. So there have been no challenges to the public health code, which is what we're issuing our orders under. And so there could be a challenge, but those laws seem pretty well established.
Sure. The president of Michigan State Senate, Mike Shirkey, called the ruling on Friday great news. He affirmed that he believes the virus is a threat, but he cast this as a problematic procedural matter that the executive cannot go forward without the legislature. And he said, quoting here, this will restore the system of checks and balances the founding fathers intended. No doubt there are some in Oakland County who might share that view. How have you been handling complaints or disputes about where masks are appropriate?
You know, we get a lot of complaints to our hotline in our health department office from residents, because by and large, the vast majority of residents and business owners in Oakland County want us to take this seriously and want us to do all the measures that we can to protect the public. And so when they call us, we investigate those either through the local police department or through our health department. And almost always we can resolve those situations. And you know, on the on the few outliers where the businesses don't want to cooperate, we have other enforcement mechanisms as well. So it's really the public that I'm finding that want us to be diligent and make sure that we keep safe.
Right. If the foundations of the policy are solid at this point, are there any problems for Oakland County, do you foresee, if the governor's authority does not stand? I mean, did you need Governor Whitmer to lay down that line?
You know, the counties or the public health departments like ours have always had this power. In fact, before the governor started issuing her first orders, we had issued some orders in Oakland County that actually went sooner. We were the first county in Michigan, for instance, to shut down shopping malls back in early March. But I've always thought that rather than have a patchwork approach, county by county or jurisdiction by jurisdiction, that it was in Michigan's best interest to have a uniform policy come from the state health department. And I think that, by the way, has served Michigan very well as we've brought our numbers down and saved lives here. So now we are going to, at least in the short term, it looks like, you know, there could be a patchwork of orders. And I don't think that serves the state of Michigan well. But my responsibility is to the voters and to the residents of Oakland County. And so that's what I'm going to be focused on. And we're going to use the health orders here to make sure we're keeping Oakland County residents safe.
You know, to that end, one of Oakland County's nearest neighbors is Macomb County. And I believe that the two have the second and third highest number of COVID infections in the state, behind yes. Wayne County when you look at total numbers. Macomb County's executive Mark Hackle has been averse to the governor's hand in fighting against COVID. Do you think it's going to be difficult to get on the same page with him about the best way to fight COVID?
Well, you know, I know that he had questions about how the governor was making her decisions and the legal authority that she used. But I haven't heard Mark say that he doesn't believe that social distancing and face masks and hand washing and the like, all this, the health protocols that we know are important, aren't still our best defense against this virus. And so I believe he understands that. And I think he will encourage the people of Macomb County to do that. How he does that, again, will be sort of a county by county base, unless a statewide plan can be developed in light of the Supreme Court ruling. But I think everyone who looks at this understands, even Senator Shirky, that masks are a common sense way to help us fight this virus.
At the same time, it looks like Macomb County, while they may be encouraging masks, is certainly not requiring it. Does that pose any problems for people who live in one county and work in the other?
I don't think it's ideal. Like I said, I think the best case scenario is that we have statewide orders on these things. But, you know, the Supreme Court has put that in flux. And so I know the governor is pursuing other avenues by which to do a statewide strategy. And I encourage that, frankly. But in the short term, I didn't want Oakland County to be caught off guard. I didn't want our businesses and our schools to think that suddenly the rules around masks had changed. Because in fact, we haven't issued more restrictive rules, but we have kept the rules in place that existed prior to the ruling. And I think that's the prudent thing to do.
We found that in retail and service sectors and other kinds of workplaces that there are some business owners who are very interested in making sure that distancing and masks are mandatory, and some who feel like it's been very difficult for their employees to police this. What will be the point of enforcement in Oakland County for masks and PPE?
Yeah, and you know, it is very difficult, and that's why we rely on the cooperation of the residents to allow our businesses to operate in a way that is safest for their employees and their clients. But we'll enforce it the way we have in the past, which is that, you know, residents or employees with a concern about a business should contact their local police or the sheriff. They will do an initial investigation or report and send it to our health division. And then we contact those businesses. And in most cases, it's just a matter of educating them on how the health protocols should be implemented. But you know, on those rare occasions where education isn't enough. There is enforcement mechanisms through our health department.
Mm-hmm. Has anything had to go beyond the point of a citation to date?
No. And I said from the beginning, you know, we're not trying to fill up Oakland County Jail with people who don't wear a mask or don't socially distance. The idea is to give the people the information in a transparent way so that they can make the best decisions for themselves. And I think since we've been doing that, the overwhelming majority of residents here in Oakland County and our businesses are really striving to do the right thing around health protocols. And so that really hasn't been necessary here.
Dave, can you tell us a little bit about what's going on right now in terms of community spread? You know, some of the other counties like Ingham County have had some real problems getting a hold on academic settings, especially higher education. What's keeping you awake nights these days in terms of COVID infections?
Well, there's a lot of things that keep me awake at night, and especially the idea that as we come into the fall season and that mixes with normal flu season, which mixes with kids going back to school, that could be a very lethal combination. And so that's something we're very mindful of. What we saw over the summer, frankly, and the reason our numbers did start to creep back up again is large gatherings. Whether that just be a graduation party, a birthday party, just picnics and the like, barbecues and whatnot. And the other thing that we've been seeing that surprises me a bit, and I want to mention it, is a number of people who don't feel quite right, but they go into work anyway. And then they end up testing positive. And what we're saying is, you know, I know there's a kind of an American spirit that says, oh, just because you're a little under the weather, you still go to work. But this is not a good time to be practicing that American ethic. If you think you have any of the signs of COVID, we strongly encourage you not to go to work and to get yourself a test. And make sure, because what we've seen is a number of employees who, you know, just kind of were fighting through what they thought was a cold or something, and they went to work. And this is not the time to do this. This is the time to err on the side of caution. We've had several situations where folks were just a little under the weather. They went to work. They ended up testing positive and spreading it to their coworkers. So very important to stay home if you don't feel well at all.
Oakland County Executive Dave Coulter. Dave, thank you for your time today.
Why, thank you very much. It was a pleasure to be with you as always.
Coming up on Stateside, author Alice Randall's new novel explores the rich legacy and people of Detroit's Black Bottom neighborhood through the eyes of those who made it a mecca of Black culture. That's after a short break. Stick around. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Alice Randall is very much at home in the city where she lives, Nashville, Tennessee. A writer in residence at Vanderbilt University, she has put her pen to hit country songs. She's done food advocacy centered on the cuisine of the Black American diaspora and has written a widely read novel set in the universe of Gone with the Wind. Looking at her CV, you might mistake her for a lifetime Southerner. But in her latest novel, Black Bottom Saints, Alice Randall lays out a feast in cinematic detail from the home of her childhood, Detroit, in the late 1960s, a Black Camelot that formed so many cornerstones of America's economic, intellectual, and artistic life. The novel is structured as a book of saints in the Catholic tradition, peopled with a range of characters that lift Black Bottom's history off the page and give voice to a place that continues to influence Detroit and the world to this day. Alice Randall, thanks for joining us. Welcome to Stateside.
April, it's wonderful to be with you.
You drop us into the story in 1967, a year when I think you yourself would have been a small kid in Detroit, right?
About 8 years old.
So our narrator, our tour guide through Black Bottom is Ziggy Johnson. He's a gossip columnist for the Black newspaper, the Michigan Chronicle, syndicated in two other cities. Alice Randall, that one detail is so loving, a gossip columnist for a Black newspaper, to think that all of those details of Black life, although small in terms of what people might consider the news events of the day, would be subject of interest and of publication. Could you tell us a little bit about the sensibility that you wanted to write with for Ziggy, who was a real person?
Well, one, Ziggy always privileged Black art aesthetics. He was a gossip columnist and an entertainment columnist, so he was steeped in Black music, Black dance, a variety of Black performances, and he was also steeped in Black language, the barbershop language of the street and the show world language. But I must note that Ziggy's language was my first language. I was born in Detroit in 1959, and the first writer I ever knew, though I, like you, would study at Harvard, but the first writer I ever knew was Ziggy Johnson. I started attending his dance school when I was 3 years old. But before I ever walked into his dance school, my father did not read to me from children's books. He read to me from newspapers. Monday through Friday, it would be the Detroit Free Press and the News. But on the weekends, it was the Michigan Chronicle. And my favorite storyteller was Ziggy.
You paint a picture of his life as an impresario at the Driftwood Lounge, booking top names in the Detroit music scene, which I guess I'm saying the top names in America at the time. And you also have him talking about the children that he taught dance to at his school, what he calls the breadwinner's children. And there's just a short passage that describes who he's talking about. Could you share that with us?
Yes, I'd love to do that. The word that explains Detroit to me, breadwinner. The partying factory people were those whom I first noticed when I arrived in the late 30s. Large numbers of Black men who earned a good steady wage doing a skilled job, then returned to the homes they owned, ready to refuel, get dressed to the nines to head out to hear fabulous music and drink good liquor. I was the breadwinner's MC of choice and producer of choice, and proud to be so. The factory folk, the breadwinners, drove the Black city. Detroit knew this. Black Detroit knew this. We gave the factory folk who worked in the automobile plants their proper respect. We loved those men who did the shift work that meant 8 out of 10 Black families in Detroit owned the home they lived in and could afford to go out to a club to hear live music any night they chose. Our breadwinners built this city. We remember when River Rouge ran 24/7, 3 shifts a day at the plant meant the show bars had 2 shows on Sunday and late shows every night, sometimes at 2 a.m. for those who got off the late shift. That was the opportunity that created Caramel Camelot.
So this world that Ziggy Johnson lives in, this is the world of the Black Bottom Saints, and he counts among them not just famous people, but also sort of everyday folks, people like a bartender named Thomas Hayden, his own mother, who was a faithful Catholic. And there were certainly folks in his reckoning like Joe Louis, Della Reese, Billy Eckstein, and the poet Robert Hayden, and you bring them all to life. Dinah Washington and her husband, the Detroit Lions great Night Train Lane. How did you go about selecting who Ziggy would want people to know about?
Well, there are 3 criteria to becoming a Black Bottom Saint. You have to know that I was working with, I had found about 1,000 of his columns published over 2 decades. So there were 3 criteria. They were, 1, that they had likely been mentioned in one of Ziggy's columns, or lots of times in Ziggy's columns. 2, Ziggy had told me or the children in his dancing school about the person. And 3, they had likely walked through the lobby of the Gotham Hotel where Ziggy lived for over a decade, and which was in old Black Detroit. So, but 4, actually, they knew something significant about trauma, moving from trauma to transcendence. Because when Ziggy talked to the students in his school about his Black Bottom Saints, he was telling us the stories that would help us move from trauma to transcendence. So he was telling us the story of Black wisdom.
Right. I think some of my favorites of the saints are the people who are just sort of semi-famous. The charm school founder, Cordy Stewart, who is this really fierce mix of control and ambition with a lot of fizz and Ada Smith, who was a celebrated singer and dancer who rubbed shoulders with James Baldwin in Paris. I don't know how you managed to choose.
I love Shirley MacNeil. Now, she is going to be a Black woman high school English teacher, but she's also going to be the person who brings transcendental meditation to the United States. That's one of the things that lets me think of myself as a blues novelist. I mean, the blues argues that no life needs to be relegated to the margins. And Ziggy, steeped in his mother's Mississippi blues background, though born in Chicago, he thought everybody was important. Long before people were talking Black Lives Matter, he was living it. And so there's space for a heroin dealer, Scatterbrain Stevens, in Ziggy's pantheon of saints, because Ziggy doesn't define people by the worst day in their life.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Alice Randall. She's the author of the new novel, Black Bottom Saints. Alice, could you talk to us about the ways that Detroit has been with you in all the places that you have gone in your life?
Absolutely. What a wonderful observation. I was born in Detroit, and I think that the chin-up swagger and the pride in just being able to outwork anybody else, but the Detroit version of that doesn't turn into John Hendry syndrome, because Detroit also privileges Black creativity and art, and not just songwriting and performing art. The Gotham Hotel was also supporting Black photographers and hosted the Shutterbug Club. So one of the things that I feel that I've had from my earliest days is a sense of art and industry that is just pure Detroit. And Detroit, even before Motown, it found one of its great flowers in Motown. But long before the Driftwood Lounge, there's going to be the Flame Show Bar. There are going to be so many clubs in Detroit. We're going to have Memphis Minnie migrating up to Detroit because it's such a great place to live. Laverne Baker, who you probably don't know, but is a second woman, not Black woman, second woman to go in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And she lives in Detroit. But who's the first woman? Aretha Franklin. She lives there too. So when I was born into Detroit in 1959, I was being born into one of the great art communities that has ever been collected in the world. We all know about Paris in the 20s, but Paris in the 20s pales compared to Detroit in the 40s.
There's a thread that runs through your prose writing that has to do with the people who get left out of history. It was certainly true of your debut novel, The Wind Ungone, that imagines this Black woman in the universe of Gone with the Wind. Her half-sister is Scarlett O'Hara. They know a lot of the same people, although Sainara, this protagonist, walks a very different path. And we see so many people speaking to us out of the pages of history through the Black Bottom Saints. Do you feel like there are benefits and limitations to how we use fiction as a tool to fill in our historic gaps?
I think for the Black experience, that using fiction to paint some of the broad strokes and some of the nuanced strokes of the inner life of African Americans from earlier periods is essential. Because so many of my ancestors were not able to leave written reports because they could not read and write in English, that if we don't take our oral histories, if we don't privilege our oral histories and translate them into fiction, we lose them. Because there are oral histories, because there isn't documentation, I think that there's an integrity in calling it fiction, but it is a fiction that often comes closer to the truth than the actual published record because of all the things the public's record, the official accounting, cannot measure. for example, the people right now who are afraid to fill out census data because they are afraid that it could be misused by immigration officials. The published record doesn't always well and truthfully document underprivileged people.
We're in this era right now where all manner of American history is being reexamined in the same way that you have torn down some of the tropes of American history in some of your books. What do you see coming out of this time?
This is a time of reckoning. And in the time of reckoning, I think that we gain greater and greater illumination. With Black Bottom Saints, I think that one of the things that we are being called upon to celebrate is cultural wisdom that in the Black experience. For example, we have gone through just recently the Me Too movement, which I think is so important. But one of the things that was under discussed that is we shine a light on in Black Bottom Saints is that Black women have been being raped in America since the first slave trade boats arrived and the first Black women arrived on plantations in America. And Black women and men and children have built some cultural currency and insight in how to transcend that extraordinary trauma. Not to minimize it, not to minimize that crime. We call out that crime. But we also call in the genius that the children born from those rapes, some of them created triumphant lives. And some of them know that joy is radical. Mm-hmm. And so to me, call in the Black experience, we celebrate that everyday mirror. And it reframes something significant. And I feel right now, the entire world, Black culture in America knows a lot about rising from the ashes. The entire world needs to rise from the ashes of a global pandemic. And there is no better group of people to spot to when trying to rise from the ashes than to contemplate the Black citizens of Detroit who live there from 48 to 68.
There's a beautiful epigraph at the start of the book that discusses that. You know, in recent years, I've heard American history described alternately as a continuum on which progress moves forward and sometimes rolls back. And sometimes I've heard it described as more of a pendulum, where progress really isn't an adaptable concept. Ta-Nehisi Coates has written a little bit about this. And I wondered which read on American history rings more true to you.
I centered in my feminine interior experience. I consider myself to be a feminist. And I think that progress is not about external events. Some of it is about internal reality, because that is the one thing we can control. So I think about individual progress independent of the external political reality. But I also think that we must always think about structural obstacles to individuals achieving their interior peace and their interior happiness. The novel is divided into four sections, which are summer, fall, winter, and spring. The saints of summer are the saints of the roots of the Black experience. The saints of fall are the saints that point out that structural obstacles can be so great that an individual cannot achieve the movement from trauma to transcendence. If you are a four-year-old girl shot dead in your own house, as Tanya Blanding was in the summer of 1967, you don't get to move from trauma to transcendence, no matter how artful you are in your interior. But the saints of winter remind us that there's geniuses of Black grit, geniuses of Black movement from trauma to transcendence. But the Saints of Spring are my favorite. They are some of the people who have the hardest lives, who despite all, despite, actually arrive at joy. So to me, that's the paradox, that progress is an ideal. It's not a reality.
Alice Randall's new novel is Black Bottom Saints. Alice, we didn't even get a chance to ask you about the many, many cultural moments that you drew from on this, both for the words and for an amazing list of cocktails that you concocted for each and every one of the saints so that libations can be part of their celebration. But the whole thing's a feast. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you. I wanted to make a five cents address to joy: the taste, the touch, the scent, the sound, the sight of joy. And adding all the cocktails allowed to me to do that, even in a novel that looks at public and private trauma. We get to rest on joy with the cocktails.
Coming up, we meet a teacher who's part of a district inviting kids back into the classroom for in-person instruction this week. But she says there's still room on her virtual roster.
I'm seeing some of those kids that are a little more shy, like all of a sudden open up a little bit because they're finding ways of communicating that works for them.
We'll meet her after the break. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Teachers began virtual instruction from the actual classroom at the beginning of the year with a plan to implement face-to-face learning later. You know how plans are going in 2020. Lauren Roberts teaches middle school science, STEM classes, and seventh grade literature in Metro Detroit. She lives in Ferndale and has been conducting her classes virtually from home. But her district is doing some in-person instruction this week. Roberts spoke with Stateside's Laura Weber Davis about what's going on in her class.
Is there any intention right now that the district is going back to in-person, or are you just adjusting to a fully remote semester at least?
Oh, wow. It's funny you say that. So it depends on what day of the week you ask. We've learned that we'll be returning in person for a kind of hybrid educational situation starting on Monday. So it's been kind of unique in the sense that we intended to be fully in person at the beginning of the school year. And shortly before we started, the determination was made that given just COVID positivity rates and the way in which the trends were moving, they decided to have teachers in the building. But yet kids were virtual at that point. And then we were trying to test the waters with having small groups of students come in. But we're seeing some challenges with COVID positivity within our school district, and a few schools had to shut down. And so pretty much immediately they sent teachers home, and we were fully remote for the last like week and a half, almost 2 weeks. And starting Monday, the plan is to have teachers back in the building and then to do sort of a soft opening with having students come in full groups at some point, but we're not sure yet exactly when that's going to take place.
I can't help but think that this just mirrors sort of the everyday family life as well, in that we're all kind of having to find ways to be completely nimble and in the moment and willing to adjust completely. Have you taken that sort of mentality going forward as a teacher?
Absolutely. And I mean, I think for me, I'm lucky that I'm just sort of a go with the flow human being. So I struggle less with this, but I can tell you that working in education, given that things are so structured and so planned out weeks or months in advance, and just the way that our industry works, there are teachers that are really struggling with this, because from one minute to the next, we're hearing different things and seeing different things on the news and talking to each other and feeling our own anxieties and fears surrounding whether we're in person or not, and how that's changing. And so for me, the Headspace app has been my best friend. I've been meditating a lot and trying to find ways to just kind of live in the moment and be okay with that, knowing that we're in a situation where things are changing so rapidly and we're expected to evolve and just kind of jump at a moment's notice to adapt or change, that that's become our new norm. And so I'm personally okay with that, but I know that some of my colleagues, you know, are really struggling.
So can you describe for us, before you go back into the classroom, what does a typical teaching day look like for you right now?
So currently I'm wearing a lot of hats. And so I guess I can preface this by saying I'm not a straight out of the gate teacher. My professional career is unique in the sense that I worked in a few different industries before I made my way into the classroom. So I worked in the entertainment music industry for 8 years and then actually went to graduate school and became a professor, worked at the collegiate level as an instructor, and then found my way into the middle school classroom, which I've been doing now for 6 years. So because of that, my sense of workflow and just my sense of like responsibilities, I have a kind of pretty wide scope of just because of my own personal experiences of working in so many different industries and doing so many different things, I can adapt pretty quickly. But I can tell you that like, I mean, my general work week as a teacher, I'm on average working about 60 to 70 hours a week. That's my general work week. So I'm looking at like at least 12, sometimes 15 hour work days, at least 5 days a week. And that's not unusual. All of the colleagues in my school are pulling similar schedules. So like, I mean, we're working around the clock. And a lot of that has to do with just, in addition to learning all of these new educational platforms and tools that then we have to teach our students how to use or adapt to pretty quickly. We're also, you know, lesson planning and joining professional development sessions and meetings and responding to literally hundreds of emails a day. So all of that kind of like is kind of on my plate at all times.
It's interesting that, you know, you seem like somebody who is able to adapt pretty nimbly. And I think that I have heard now several parents say they have been surprised how easily their kids have been able to adapt as well to the new situation.
Yeah.
Even from little teeny kids adapting to teachers wearing masks, all the way up to middle school and high school, being able to adapt to not being around their friends. Tell me from your seat where you are, how the kids are adapting in your classroom.
Oh my gosh. I honestly, like, thank goodness for my students. They are the most like brilliant, wonderful people ever. And I think, I mean, that's a huge part of my job is just like, is as many challenges as I face as a teacher, like my kids are, they are the reason why I do what I do. And they are like, I have 30 students in a classroom. We're all in physically totally different spots. We're all working on totally different devices. So whether a student's working on a MacBook versus a Chromebook versus a tablet, you know what, even the way in which they see the platform or how to start or take the test looks and feels completely different. And so I'm in a totally different place trying to make this all work. And so, you know, it not only are they working together and fully, you know, putting educational tools to work, they're doing a way that's really kind and supportive. And that's the kind of classroom that I try to nurture. So it's seeing that in action is always just really amazing. And I mean, we did it. So it was great.
So there's this other side to middle school is just such an interesting time of life. And for me and many of my friends, in reflection, probably some of the hardest years of one's seminal years. And I'm just keep thinking that maybe going virtual or having a hybrid school system and having the whole thing disrupted might be really beneficial for some of those lingering unpleasantries of being in middle school. Have you seen any of that?
For sure. I think one thing that's really unique and really interesting is the way in which it's completely changed how we communicate in a classroom. You know, we're so used to, and I mean, it's a challenge, but also kind of a really amazing thing. Like a lot of the visual cues of just being in person and face to face are now kind of gone or almost gone. You know, it's like they can see me behind a screen, but you know, it's totally different than being in person. They can't always hear the inflections of my voice change, or they can't always see like when I'm super excited about it and my face lights up. Like they can see me smile, but it's different than when we're in person. And so because of that, that's kind of tough sometimes because I can't always necessarily read the room with them, so to speak. Right. You know, it's like they can sometimes put on a good face. But The thing that is also really beneficial and kind of amazing is that because our communication channels have totally changed, like we're often in these live class sessions together, but we have these tools like chat boxes and like one-on-one chats where sometimes I'll have students privately chat me in the middle of class. I'll be talking, you know, or lecturing, or we'll be in a small group doing something. And they'll even be with their group mates, you know, working on a project or an assignment. And they'll chat to me directly. And they'll be like, "Miss Roberts, I'm not feeling super good today. You know, or I don't really feel like sharing this answer, but I want to tell you what I'm thinking. Mm-hmm. But I'm worried that like my group mates may not agree. Can I run this idea by you?" So all of a sudden it creates these like different channels of communication that make them feel like they're in a safe space, even when middle school may seem scary, you know, especially for the younger students, like the sixth graders that are really new to middle school and are really feeling things out, or maybe the older kids that are a little shyer and more introverted and are less apt to kind of just jump in full force in a face-to-face classroom. It gives them the ability to kind of ease into either activities or communication. And I'm seeing some of those kids that are a little more shy, like all of a sudden open up a little bit because they're finding ways of communicating that works for them, that feels authentic and not as scary as like raising your hand in class and everyone listening to your answer.
Well, Lauren, I feel like I probably know the answer to this question already, but I have to ask, of all the hats that you've worn professionally, if you knew what you know now about pandemic teaching and the difficulties or the types of adjustments it has required of you, would you still go into teaching?
Oh my gosh, yeah. I mean, I will be fully honest with you, it is the most difficult thing I've ever done in my life. Like hands down, bar none. It is just, it requires so much energy and effort and just like, I mean, sometimes I'm not only physically exhausted, but just emotionally exhausted by the things that I take on and the challenges that my students share with me. And I mean, it comes from a place of like, I love them and want to support them. And sometimes, you know, that means that you're giving all you've got, you know, 150% of you all day, every day, all the time. It's a job that never turns off ever. And even on times that people think I'm off the clock, you know, whether it's weekends or during the summer when I'm doing a million other things like professional development and this and that, my kids are always on my mind. I mean, I have students that reach out to me years later. In fact, recently I was just around town and I was at the grocery store and ran into a student that I had as a fifth grader the first year ever that I taught as a student teacher, gosh, 11 years ago. And she recognized me and was like, "Miss Roberts." And I mean, now it's a 21-year-old student, 22-year-old, you know, woman in the world. And I immediately recognized her and both of us just burst into tears. You know, it was one of those things I was like overjoyed to see her. And it's like, so knowing that, you know, like knowing I knew what I was up against when I became a teacher. This is a choice that I made, but I cannot imagine doing anything else. Like I am just knowing that I've made it a positive impact on even one person's life, little and maybe a lot of people's lives over the course of so many years, and seeing that come full circle later on. I mean, like, I can't imagine doing anything else, honestly.
Lauren Roberts, good luck getting back into the classroom.
Thank you. I'll need some luck, but we've got this.
This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Getting out to see the change of seasons has been a much-needed diversion this year. That may be especially true this fall, as many of us are starting to think ahead to those cooped-up months of winter down the road. And Michigan's fall foliage has obliged in a pretty big way. The trees look amazing right now. Mark Torregrossa is chief meteorologist for MLive, and he's been writing about this lately. Mark, welcome to Stateside.
Hey, hello, thank you.
So you noted recently that the leaves turned awfully fast this year. When would you normally expect to see a lot of our leaves changing color?
Well, it depends on where you're at in Michigan. So, you know, usually it's peak color about the first week of October in the UP, about the second week in northern lower, and it works its way down through southern lower third and fourth week. But what I've found is that you need some cold mornings. And we had those in September, and that started it right then. Mm-hmm. Whereas some years, we might wait until early October before we have frosting temperatures.
Yeah. So how are things looking in the UP right now?
Right now, they're looking great. On MLive, we kind of ask for reader-submitted pictures. And the pictures that we've been seeing from the western half of the UP show that that area was in peak this past weekend, and it should be working its way southward. We had some cold temperatures all across the state Saturday and Sunday morning, and so it's just going to accelerate everything. Next 2 weeks, the fall colors will just explode.
Yeah, I noticed on your Facebook page people were sending in some gorgeous pictures from like around Taquamenon Falls. Are there any other spots that looked really lit up to you that you'd recommend for driving or hiking through?
Well, immediately, if it was in the next few days or this week, probably, those mountains, the Porcupine Mountains out in the western part of the UP, the pictures coming from there always look stellar. And then you've got the whole, like I said, the next 2 weeks as it works its way southward through the state. And one nice thing about Michigan, one nice thing and one bad thing that you have to remember when you're looking for fall leaves, what else do we love to look at here in Michigan? The waterline, the beach. You know, so a lot of people try to combine the two. Let's go look at the fall colors near the beach. And the beach is usually warmer, and it's usually a week to 10 days behind inland. So they're kind of counterproductive. You might have to stay inland away from the water for a week to see the fall colors. And the nice thing is you get an extended season here in Michigan, where a lot of states not surrounded by water are done with the fall colors. Old Mission Peninsula and Traverse City can sometimes be 2, even 3 weeks later than the surrounding inland areas of Traverse City.
Now, if the trees looked good last weekend, if we're seeing pictures on people's pages, would they still be worth going to see next weekend if the weather's a little more cooperative?
Well, I got to put the plug in. Check the Wednesday update on MLive,
of course.
Probably. And here's the other thing that a lot of folks don't realize is a great fall color season is brought on by quiet weather, where we don't got to get a lot of wind and rain to yank those leaves off, because all of the trees aren't in sync at once in fall color. But if you don't get the wind, you don't get the storm systems and a ton of rain, those leaves that have changed will stay on. The leaves that haven't changed will catch up, and you'll have a great fall. And that could be what we're setting up for, because we don't see a lot of big storm systems. So to answer your question, I would say yes. I don't think that in this week all of the leaves will fall off of the peak areas, because we have fairly quiet winds.
So do you think this is going to be one of those years when the leaves are going to be more or less down by Halloween?
It takes a storm system to yank them down, and it looks fairly quiet. So it'll be close. It's hard to predict, I would be honest with you there.
Well, I guess asking a meteorologist to predict 25 days down the road is probably not the fastest way to get a straight answer. I don't know why I thought I could pin you down on that one. But thanks.
I mean, if I saw a couple of big storm systems winding up and making a lot of wind, I would say yes. But I think it's going to be fairly quiet. And I think we could get a magical time in the really colorful areas, say, of central lower Michigan, where you got a lot of hardwoods, up through the Gaylord and Grayling area. I think we could get a magical time where most of the leaves are still on the trees and the trees have peaked. The other thing I'd like to mention is that Mother Nature doesn't always have the leaves peak on the weekend. We like to look at the week and say, will they be peaked this weekend? Well, they might actually peak Tuesday or Wednesday in a certain place and be a little past peak by a weekend. So you kind of have to go do your leaf viewing when Mother Nature says you have to do it.
Well, Mark, thank you so much for the advice. And we just love those pictures. Thanks for posting them.
Okay, get out and enjoy it, because we know what the next pictures come of, right?
Oh, the yeah.
The next great season with the white stuff on the ground.
Mark Torregrossa, MLive's chief meteorologist. Mark, take care.
You too.
And that's Stateside for today. I'm April Bear. Thanks for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.